Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very honored. It's been a great desire of mine to have John Ashbery as my guest on Bookworm. And, you know, for many years, I've been reading his poems. Since I was a student, John Ashbery gave me his book, Three Poems, when it had first come out. And I guess I've been reading him constantly ever since. For me, he's a kind of connoisseur of wonderlands, if you bear in mind that wonderland can be chaotic, that what goes on there is often an exchange of incomprehensions, that the people that one meets are often not very nice to one, that anything can follow, non sequiturs are the rules in wonderland. And in addition, wonderland incorporates a good deal of parody, pastiche, extraordinary events that take place at bewildering speeds. And I am happiest, I guess. I remember when I first read the Alice books, in the forest where things lose their names. Alice is pictured in the famous illustration by Tennille, clutching a fawn, not knowing who she is, which is often, for me, the effect, thrilling and bewildering, of Ashbery's poetry. I wanted to begin by asking you if that kind of nonsense and Wonderland itself was important to you.
Well, yes. I certainly Alice in Wonderland is one of the first and major books I've ever read. And it seems very much a reflection of the world that we live in and has a lot to teach us about it, I guess.
Well, I think so, too. John Ashbery's new book is A Worldly Country. It's published by Echo. I noticed that this book has epigraphs both from Auden and from Empson. And I know that British poetry has been very important to you. Could you talk about that a bit?
Well, it was, yes, when I was in high school and began reading contemporary poetry and writing it myself. At that time, Auden was considered the greatest living poet in English, at any rate, even more so than Eliot, because Eliot was already had a kind of a historical figure. And when I began reading modern poetry, I was as puzzled as everybody else is when they first encounter it. And although Auden would not seem to be one of the more fearsome or difficult modern poets, to me he was. I couldn't understand, for instance, how he was allowed to get away with using slang and popular song lyrics and have those at the same time in conjunction with old English forms and archaic language, and all of it kind of mashed together in a kind of slurry that seemed to me something that you weren't allowed to do in poetry. And it was, I guess, coming to terms with this situation that got me really interested and involved in writing myself and in trying to explore the ways in which the implications of this situation of the mélange de tout, a kind of, you know, potpourri kind of poetry.
Jan, I didn't like him when he became understandable. Did you feel that way?
Well, yes, and he hadn't yet done that when I started reading him. This would have been around 1944, 1945, and Auden's later poetry hadn't yet come along. And what I was reading was what he had written in England before coming to the United States in 1939, and as well as the more recent ones, such as the Sea in the Mirror, the wonderful version of The Tempest that he wrote after getting to America, and For the Time Being, a sort of Christmas oratorio, and then The Age of Anxiety, which came in 1947, which, again, a kind of a dramatic mask, which uses the Middle English verse.
The Icelandic.
Yeah.
The thrill for me was the orators and that play Paid on Both Sides.
Yeah, those I think are his greatest works, and he characteristically sort of denied them or denounced them. He did allow the orators to be reprinted finally in the 60s, but with a little introductory note saying that he thought he was insane when he wrote it. And the older Auden, who was very sort of commonsensical, no longer believed in poetry with a capital P, as he put it, and didn't believe that it should be privileged or funny. I mean, funny, peculiar. And I still prefer his early work.
You know, when I started reading you, I guess what I liked immediately was that it made the noises of poetry, but it didn't seem like poetry. You know, it seemed like almost as if it were an impersonation of poetry by someone who loved it but didn't want to write it as it had been before.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think that's a way of putting it, yeah. Also, I think that you can sort of take any line of Auden's poetry of the 30s and early 40s, and no matter what it is, if it's something that's not even a complete sentence, you realize that you're in a poem, that you can relax, that this is a guy who writes poetry. I'm trying to think of an example of a line, for instance. Well, there's one poem that begins, "Consider this and in our time." And it doesn't really matter what this is. You already know that this is going to be poetry.
It's also aligned to something that I once heard you say. It made me very happy, because when I was in school, people liked to take self-portrait in a convex mirror and show you the development of its thought. And I had read that you'd said that it was meant to sound like a lecture that you were at and that you were falling asleep during and could barely follow what was being said, except that it was making the noise of a lecture.
I don't remember saying that, but I can believe that I did, and it's the noise of poetry that's important, and what the message of the lecture is a lot less urgent for me.
It seems to me, too, because, see, this is a funny thing to say, but when I read Flowchart, sometimes I'll read it late at night, and the hour is progressing, and it seems to me suddenly I've landed in a place where it makes complete sense. And I can't believe that this is happening. I'm almost lit and incandescent with the possibility, and then I'll wake up in the morning to read it again and can't find what it was that I thought was there. And I wondered, are you aware of these poems flicking off and on in insignificance?
Well, I'm not. I don't know that I am, but this certainly is the way dreams operate, and Alice in Wonderland, as you said, and it's the these truths are somehow much more convincing to me, and I think to a lot of us than what we are being told we have to understand right now. We're being told that in a dream too, but we're taking it from the source.
Yes, I think that we're dreaming all the time.
I agree.
I forget whose it was, but someone said that dreams are like the underground river, and that from time to time a fish from that river jumps and appears in daylight and then falls again, but that constantly underneath what we think we're thinking, mm-hmm. there's something else that's running in parallel and is always the present to us. Yep. There's never a moment in which consciousness is single.
Yeah, that's mentioned in a novel by the Austrian writer von Dodower, that there is a constant current in our minds that's flowing according to its own program, and that at any moment one can let down a bucket and pull up some water, which is always from the same river, no matter what has happened since the last time we examined it.
There's also a sentence in von Dodower which goes something like, he's talking about his own career, first you break the windows, then you are the windows. And I wondered...
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I wondered if you had that sensation, because I know you say in one of the early essays that a poet's job is to defy criticism.
Well, I was perhaps going overboard a little when I said that. Perhaps I was stinging from some early critical spankings I had received, but that again is I guess one of my ideas that I took from elsewhere. It's Cocteau said that one should read criticism of oneself very carefully so as to be able to not do all of the things critics tell you should do, in fact, to go against them and do the opposite.
But do you have a sense of having become one of the windows that needs to be broken now?
No, I don't, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if that were the case. Time and literary history don't stop, and there is always more breaking to be done. I'm reminded in that regard with the very beginning of Gertrude Stein's novel, The Making of Americans. She quotes this anecdote about, you probably could phrase
it
better than
I. Let's see if we can do it.
It said a man was being dragged by his son through his own orchard, and when they came to a certain tree, the man yelled, "Stop, I never dragged my own father farther than this tree."
and someone told me that that's actually from Virgil.
I know it was from somewhere else, but I didn't know where.
No, it's kind of astonishing. I also wanted to talk to you about something that you said that I think is absolutely thrilling. You were talking about Gertrude Stein, which is why I bring it up. Talking about her really magnificent stanzas in Meditation, and you say, yes, there is monotony, but let's remember that water flows monotonously over the falls, generating electrical power. and I find that one of the things that people have lost track of is an interest in boredom and monotony.
Yeah, as long as it's the right kind of monotony. And what do I mean by that? Well, I guess the kind that produces electricity, and you have to encounter it first to know whether that's going to be the case.
You're writing about Alfred Chester, and you say that at a certain point in literature, it seems that Chester, Burroughs are interested in finding the world still more awful than Jean Genet found it. and that somehow the idea that the world is awful is addressed to the reader who's meant to feel guilty for having occasioned this awfulness. And it reminded me of that interest in not judging, in being ambivalent, that these poems are not about, well, even the Auden effect of the age of anxiety. It's not a scold. You're not telling people what to think.
Well, I hope not, yeah, and I think not. But yes, I find in some of those writers and in other ones, say, like Céline, for instance, there's this sort of hectoring subtext that you are somehow responsible for all of the horrors that I'm dredging up for you to look at.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Ashbery, author most recently of A Worldly Country, published by Echo. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Ashbery about his new book of poems, A Worldly Country. This is John Ashbery reading from his new book.
Yeah, this is the title poem, A Worldly Country. It's rather unusual for me in that it rhymes, although I used to write rhyming poems when I first started writing poetry because I thought it would be hard to do, and discovered that it wasn't, so went on to writing non-rhyming poetry. A worldly country. Not the smoothness, not the insane clocks on the square, the scent of manure in the municipal parterre, not the fabrics, the sullen mockery of Tweety Bird, not the fresh troops that needed freshening up. If it occurred in real time, it was okay. And if it was time in a novel, that was okay, too. From palace and hovel, the great parade flooded avenue and byway, and turnip fields became just another highway. Leftover bonbons were thrown to the chickens and geese, who squawked like the very dickens. There was no peace in the bathroom, none in the china closet, or the banks, where no one came to make a deposit. In short, all hell broke loose that wide afternoon. By evening, all was calm again. A crescent moon hung in the sky like a parrot on its perch. Departing guests smiled and called, "See you in church." For night, as usual, knew what it was doing, providing sleep to offset the great ungluing that tomorrow again would surely bring. As I gazed at the quiet rubble, one thing puzzled me. What had happened and why? One minute we were up to our necks in rebelliousness, and the next, peace had subdued the ranks of hellishness. So often it happens that the time we turn around in soon becomes the shoal our pathetic skiff will run aground in. And just as waves are anchored to the bottom of the sea, we must reach the shallows before God cuts us free.
John Ashbery, reading the title poem from his new collection, A Worldly Country.
I should do that more often. I think there's a real pleasure in rhyming things like highway and byway and chickens and dickens.
Well, I remember thinking when some of the rhyming poems started to appear that they were kind of like dum-dum poems. The point was to rhyme dumb.
Yes.
And that the poem gave the impression of an idiot who thought that this is poetry. You know, this is what a poem is supposed to sound like. Do I remember correctly? Is it in the Ella Wheeler Wilcox?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of crazy section in which, you know, someone who thinks that poetry is about making majestic statements and rhyming them too,
yes.
Both at the same time.
That's the Calypso section.
Yeah. It's kind of amazing. What is it that, I mean, it's a kind of making fun, yes, of people who think poetry is this.
Well, I more than that, I think it's a kind of redeeming sort of thematic or disesteemed material and having it saying, this is poetry too. And even our, you know, the little rhymes that occur to us when we're shaving or eating breakfast, have a right to exist just as much as high flown.
Now, is that inclusion of disesteemed material, disowned material, is that part of the democracy of poems?
I think it should be, and I've always felt very warmly towards clichés and use them a lot. And the reason being that they're the way we talk when we talk to each other and are trying very hard to make ourselves understood and to make people like us or get something that we want. And that we resort to these sort of age-old, tired expressions, which to me have a kind of holiness about them just because they've been used so much by people to communicate and touch each other. And I'm sort of for a democracy of stylistic elements such as self-conscious, poetical language, crude slang, journalistic prose, textbook kind of boring exposition. I see all these as kind of rolling around with each other and being a kind of medium of communication that is what poetry tries to function as.
Now, when you were writing A Nest of Ninnies with James Schuyler, that novel is sort of like an amazing anthology of the dead things that people say that are hilarious. You know, I find it impossible to read without laughing out loud. How did you get so good? I mean, did you practice the celebration of the maudlin? You know, that kind of procession, really, of perfectly dumb phrases that everyone says.
Well, we never expected that this work would see the light of day. We wrote it really to amuse each other. And I think we were both kind of remembering our kind of lonesome and boring childhood. And both of us in upstate, in small towns in upstate New York, of course, we didn't know each other then. And what our parents would say, what we heard on the radio, in newsreels, funny, popular expressions that didn't last very long, and that we were kind of preserving in this way.
Well, sort of like "See You in Church" in the poem that you just
yes.
read.
I don't know if anybody still says that.
I doubt it.
Of course, it was said not meaning literally "I'll see you in church," but it was just a way of saying "so long."
Now, those last two lines of "A Worldly Country," in which God is invoked in a final couplet, and anticipating a freedom that comes once you reach the shallows. And this poem, in its rhymes at least, is interested in shallowness, you know, a kind of mm-hmm. reward almost for the long haul. And I was talking to you once on the phone about de Chirico and his late realistic charcoal sketches, that sense that now it's time to go and do what everyone does. The great experiment is sort of over, and he's just waiting to be taken, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, it is sort of an ambiguous deliverance, and I'm nothing if not ambiguous, because I feel it's a way of crowding extra meaning into whatever I write. Since God is cutting us free, that's a kind of slightly ominous operation. In fact, operation is, I guess, what it is. And what is it? What are we being freed from? I guess we're being freed from the depth, and which is a good thing, since it means we won't drown. But on the other hand, we're being delivered to the shallows, and maybe that's not such a good thing either. It's not so good for our heads. And I wanted a kind of complicated sort of deliverance at the end of that poem, and that's part of it, I think.
There it is, yeah. I'm talking with John Ashbery, author most recently of A Worldly Country, published by Echo. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojcik at the Carnegie Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.